In this episode, we speak with Hari Balakrishnan, the founder and CTO of Cambridge Mobile Telematics, or CMT, the world's leading telematics and analytics provider for insurers, rideshares, and fleets. CMT was founded in 2012 based on research at MIT. It subsequently received significant backing from SoftBank Vision Fund. CMT's platform uses innovative mobile sensing, statistics, AI, and behavioral science to accurately measure driving quality, improve driving behavior, and help people in car crashes with real-time assistance. Hari has been a professor at MIT since 1998. He also co-founded Streambase Systems, which was acquired by TIBCO. I'm your host, RJ Lumba. We hope you enjoy the show. If you like the episode, click to follow.
RJ Lumba is the executive chairman of Market Insight Media and the managing partner of GrowthCap. He is the host of Great Entrepreneurs, a podcast for driven entrepreneurs and business owners. Our podcast covers all topics related to the entrepreneurial journey, from ideation to execution to optimization and to reaping the rewards of a well-run business. In the minutes ahead, we'll share with you unique insights and tactics from some of today's most accomplished and inspiring entrepreneurs.
Hari, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It's a delight to be with you.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So where I'd like to start is the technology that you provide. I think it's fairly ubiquitous. People may not even know that they are using your technology through their devices if they are an end user of one of your insurance partners. So tell us about kind of your flagship technology and how it gets incorporated into some of people's daily lives.
So at CMT, our company, our mission is to make the world's roads and drivers safer. And we do that by partnering with some of the biggest, most leading brands and companies in insurance, in the automotive industry, in commercial mobility companies, and increasingly in the public sector. And today, our penetration is largest in the insurance space. So if you have an insurance policy from a company like a State Farm or Progressive or any of the other large or medium or small insurance carriers, and they have an insurance telematics program, chances are that it's based on technology that is developed and products developed by CMT. So for example, there are companies which have an app that can measure your driving, and sometimes it goes together with an IoT device, like a tag device. So State Farm's Drive Safe and Save is an example. Progressive has a Snapshot mobile program. That's another example of this. And all of that is powered by the products that CMT has developed over about the past 10 plus years.
Mm-hmm. And it's no small feat what you've been able to accomplish. I mean, this is sophisticated technology that looks simple on the outside, but it actually is very powerful and it does a lot. So maybe for the benefit of our audience, can you explain kind of everything your technology can do within the phone?
Right, that's a great question. So I want to first start by sharing a little bit of what is happening with road safety in the US and around the world. If you take, for example, 2019 and you compare that with 2022, even though cars have become a lot safer with a lot of technology in the car, not a lot of people know that per mile or per kilometer driven, crash rates, serious crashes and fatalities have actually gone up 20% per mile driven in that time frame. There's a large number of reasons for that. In fact, taking a step back and going further back in time, from about 2010 or so, the rate of crashes has actually been rising on American roads. And that's also true in many other countries. If you think about what changed around 2009 and 2010 timeframe, it was the advent of the smartphone. And these things, I call these things weapons of mass distraction. Mm. And people are addicted. And often they're addicted while driving. And that's really the core of the problem. But in addition, people have become less attentive while driving. Of course, traffic has gone up and crashes have gone up, broadly speaking. Our hypothesis when we started the company, which actually came out of research that I led with a colleague, Sam Madden at MIT between 2004, 2005, and 2010, was that we could use these smartphones as a force for good, the same devices that are probably leading, or in fact, we know leading to an increase in crashes, have a large number of sensors in them. accelerometers, gyroscope, velocity sensors, position sensors, and a wide swath of sensors that we can use with the user's consent to record only when they're driving and to capture information from these sensors and process that information to understand how people are driving. Mm-hmm. Well, how's the vehicle moving? Is there a lot of hard braking activity? Is there a lot of phone distraction? Is there excessive speeding, way higher than what other people are doing? Lots of harsh accelerations. And we can develop a suite of risk factors that can measure people's drive. But it's not just about measurement. We can then protect people in crashes. When they get into a crash, the sensors are able to identify in real time whether the crash is a minor crash or is a severe crash. And if it is, we can send roadside assistance or at least make a wellness check to help people in times of need. But that's not the only part of the story. In addition, we're able to combine behavioral incentives from principles and from behavioral economics to incentivize people to become better drivers. This could be in the form of our partners supplying insurance discounts for demonstrated safe driving, to reward programs, to various types of real-time feedback that coach people to become better drivers. And it looks really simple at the end where, you know, do this, you can figure out how to become a safer driver and make a lot of savings, have a great deal of savings on your insurance discounts. But underneath, there are some very challenging AI, signal processing, machine learning problems that our team has tackled, where fundamentally it's taking noisy, high volume sensor data and drawing inferences from it. And over the last several years, we've processed 27 to 30 petabytes. A petabyte is 1,000 terabytes. So we're talking about 27,000 to 30,000 terabytes of sensor data that's being collected by people driving in order to more deeply understand how they're driving and what we can do to make them better drivers.
And are these sensors based on the phone itself, that hardware, or are these sensors like that are embedded into the car?
Great question. When we started the company, we started with only phone sensors because that was the most scalable way we thought we could bring telematics into the consumer world. And that had some good initial success and is now showing substantial scale and penetration. So it was a good intuition. And at that time, most people thought, oh, you couldn't do it with the phone, you know, it moves all the time. How are we going to get accuracy and so on? We really had pioneering technology that demonstrated you could do it. About 10 years ago, we also invented a small IoT device, and now we have a family of them. It's called the Drivewell Tag, and that has its own sensors. It's mounted to the windshield, and we've actually shipped over 34 million of them around the world. And that has its sensors. It communicates via Bluetooth to the phone, so you get much better information, and you get information even when there's a driver without a phone present. You can actually understand how driving is happening, so you get better coverage. Today, we process data from third-party devices as well on our platform and the sensors in the vehicle as well. Connected car data is rising. And our platform, the so-called Drivewell Fusion platform, it brings together all these different data sources. So we don't believe one is better than the other. We believe that they've all got good and not so good aspects of it. And our job is to make them all look good, bring them all together. And you could even combine them. You could get vehicle information from the car and phone distraction information from the phone and come up with a deeper understanding of what drives people's risk or safety and incentivize that. And we also have video products. We work with video as well, which of course is more expensive to deploy at scale, but there's a number of vehicles with video capabilities, dash cam capabilities as well. So at this point, the purpose of the platform is unification and fusion of many different data sources. So we don't have this philosophy that one data source is the best. I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. They're all useful, and mm-hmm. our job is to make them usable.
Mm-hmm. You know, what's fascinating about you is that you're also a professor at MIT. You've been a professor there for a long period of time, decades, but you're also an entrepreneur. You've had a series of successes. How do you balance the two? You know, I'm familiar with universities trying to get a lot of their research to be commercialized, to be productized, and to have entrepreneurs and something that's trying to pair up the entrepreneur. But you're kind of one in the same. How were you able to do two things at once?
Well, if you think about it fundamentally, many academics, many professors, you have to be very entrepreneurial to be a successful professor in a research-oriented institution. Of course, there's teaching, and that's critically important, and we all love teaching. If you're an academic, you like teaching. But on the research side, being entrepreneurial is important because you join a university, and you're given some amount of startup resources, and after that, you're on your own. You got to go find your funding, recruit your group, manage them, have a vision for where the research is going, put it together. The products, though, are number one, the students who come out of it, and number two, the papers and other artifacts that you produce out of it. But 80% of that job is very similar to entrepreneurship, except over a different time scale. Academia and research runs on a longer time scale. So when I'm with my professor hat on and my research hat, I'm not looking to influence a product next year. I'm looking to influence industry in 5 to 7 or sometimes 10 years. It takes time. And I don't want to be doing things that I can productize next year because companies ought to be doing that. Some professors, and I think there's an increasing number of them, are also really into direct entrepreneurship as opposed to entrepreneurship where the students go start something or they're a technical advisor or they help start something and after that it goes off on its own. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a great model. Some of them license to other companies. But my approach, and I think we see that in a number of professors, is I love the ability to take something into the real world and deal with those challenges. So for me, it's about learning. It's about understanding the journey. There's a lot of similarities. There's some key differences. But, you know, I've done that. I should say MIT is really fantastic, a fantastic place to do something like this because, broadly speaking, it's a very supportive environment for this. There's a encouragement given to professors to, you know, have their technology see the light of day. It's one of the key aspects of, I think our motto is mind in hand, mens et manus. And so it's really about making sure we are able to have an impact on the world with in practice. And, you know, there are rules that we follow around conflict of interest. So I keep separate my academic activities completely from my entrepreneurship and manage my time. And in a company, it's not about the individual, it's about the team and making sure we have an amazing team that does it. But I've enjoyed it. I've had this one foot in industry in one way or another for the past 20 years, and I've been a professor about 25. I think actually the past 23 years, I've been involved in some company or another.
Mm-hmm. And are there some kind of unique advantages? Like, for example, you can identify some of the top talent among your student body as you're teaching them, and you say, hey, listen, like, you'd be a great fit for one of my companies.
I don't do much of that. I mean, when I teach students or when I advise students, I'm really much more focused on what's good for the student. Mm-hmm. Of course, in some cases, it's good for them to join a growth company or a startup. Sometimes it's a big company. Sometimes it's go big or a professor. So it also depends a lot on the student. So I do find that many students outside of my own classes come and talk to me a lot because they are interested in career choices in industry or understanding startups and so on. I learned over the years never to give direct advice to anyone, never tell anyone what to do. Tell them all the possibilities and let them figure it out. I never actively recruit that way to my company, partly because I like to keep those worlds separate. But as it turns out, we do have a large number of people. I don't know the number, but we do have a number of former MIT students, many of whom I didn't teach or wasn't working with. But I would say that where the academic mindset helps in entrepreneurship is in being able to understand the timescales over which certain things are possible. And, you know, some things can move fast, some things can go slower. And CMT is a good example of that. The first 4 or 5 years of CMT were slow because we were way ahead with our technology than the market was ready. And there were only a small number of our prospective customers who were with us on that journey because most people, it was very unproven, except for the very early adopters who were really engaged with us as partners to bring these technologies to market, because almost everyone at that point would be like, this is not possible. These sensors are unreliable. The phones are unreliable. You can't get accuracy. People don't want to use it. I mean, this is like every objection. And all you need is one or two people saying, yes, I have a lot more patience. And as an academic, you kind of understand, I feel, at least I have an understanding of how to manage longer term projects, but yet make progress without waiting until, you know, I can't wait 3 years. We have to work every day, every week, every month, so that we can see an outcome in 2 to 3 years. So I think that mindset has certainly helped. The ability to deal with ambiguity is something that you get through a research program. It's not just professors. Everyone who goes through a PhD program has to deal with a lot of ambiguity and make decisions in the face of uncertain information. That's really good training for not just a founder. I mean, anyone in that early stage, you're going to have to work with a lot of ambiguous and sometimes incorrect information and make good judgment calls. So in that sense, it's happening. But not at a transactional level, I've stayed away from telling students what to do. And now I have kids, you know, a couple of teenage plus kids. And if you tell them to do something, you're going to get the opposite. So better to tell them all the options and let them make that decision.
Yeah, thinking about the entrepreneurial journey, you know, it can be a very difficult one. And I'm curious if you've ever experienced very tough times, almost existential crises, and if so, how you were able to kind of get through it.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think everybody who does something entrepreneurial experiences that, I believe. So first thing is I have two co-founders, Bill Powers, who's my business partner and has been for the past 15th year now. So we're in our 15th year together. And Sam Madden, my MIT colleague, with whom I did the research work before, and we did this. And we have had some very early people who joined our company 11, 12 plus years ago who are still with us. They're just an amazing group of people to do it with. But Bill and I in particular have dealt with a lot of the stress and the tension. So the first thing I'll say is I think being a lone entrepreneur without a partner is likely to be incredibly hard. I would never do it. And CMT is an example of that. I mean, I think it's a needless torture. Plus, it's not fun. You know, You want someone to share the journey with at all levels. We've had issues. I mean, there was a point in time where we had probably not that much money left in the bank. You know, I think the story of our company is very interesting because we didn't get venture funding for the first many years. Our first institutional money came about, you know, we launched our first product in 2012. We incorporated in 2010 on a small business grant from the National Science Foundation, $150,000. Louis Girard, who was a research scientist and previously postdoc in my group for many years, he was the lone wolf, and we had a couple of other people helping him. He's been there from day zero. And we didn't take venture money. In fact, I think we actually went out looking with various storylines and, you know, a pitch. And we actually didn't secure venture funding, believe it or not. So we did it the old-fashioned way. We went and convinced customers to use these products and to pilot things. And we grew like that. And so we raised our first institutional money about 6 years after our first product launch from SoftBank, the Vision Fund. And it was a fairly sizable investment. At the time, Boston Globe called it the largest technology investment in New England. It was $500 million. But over that time frame, you know, obviously to run a business like that, you have to be mostly almost always profitable and be very fiscally prudent and understand how to do it. We almost ran out of money. I think I remember there were cases where we told some of the more senior people that, and they were very cooperative. They were all in. I think we deferred the payment. You know, obviously we ended up making sure they were compensated in equity, but at the time the equity wasn't worth anything. And then we got some strategic partners. Some of our customers really liked us, so they started putting amounts of investment into the company, and that allowed us to really get more traction. But yeah, I think that probably the hardest thing was trying to figure out, it's the equivalent of seeing the light at the end of a tunnel, but the light is from a train that's coming at you, and you got to adapt. And I think a huge amount of credit to my partner, Bill, and to our team for understanding it. And of course, you don't want to share all of the tension with everybody because then they don't get to do their job. So you have to be optimistic. You have to have a lot of belief and you have to convince your customers to believe in you. And we managed to do all that. But I think, yeah, that existential challenge, we never really felt that we were going to stop. We always felt we'll find a way. I don't know what it is. We'll find a way. And so I think that's what kept us going. And, you know, we're still here.
Mm-hmm. Now, you went from not raising outside capital to a huge influx of capital. How did that change your behavior? I can imagine it was quite difficult because all of a sudden you have a lot of money to put to work. So you have a budgeting exercise and figuring out what's the highest and best use of each dollar that we allocate out. So your kind of role changed, it would seem.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think what we did was interesting. We decided that we would retain our focus on profitability. And really continue to use the investment as a growth vector that was very strategic, rather than we're just going to burn a lot of money in hiring, you know, excessively, and then figuring out what we should do. So we actually didn't really dip into it in any significant way or even at all operationally. We've used it for things like acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
And we've used it to hire key people who understand how to grow,
mm-hmm.
to scale our company. And it's not like, you know, we're about 450 people. We have offices mostly in the US, 275 odd people in the US. We have about 100 plus in Europe. We have about 40 in Chennai in India. We have about 10 or so in Tokyo. But we haven't gone and hired 2,000 people. What we're using it instead for is things like M&A and certain strategic growth opportunities. We did invest toward building a couple of adjacent products that otherwise would have taken us more time to build. We did invest in taking some risks on some of those products, but it was all done in a very prudent way, very similar to the exercise we were doing before, except investing more in R&D for what you might think of as Horizon 2 and Horizon 3, mm-hmm. rather than hiring a lot of people to expand, say, sales and marketing.
Got it. We're coming up on time. I do have a couple last questions I'd like to end with. One is, can you tell us about a person who has had a profound influence on you?
Yeah, many people have had a profound influence. I would say that the first is, I think my parents have had a huge amount of influence on me. I mean, they're both theoretical physicists. They're both theoretical physics professors. Research was in our house when I was growing up. And between them and my sister is also a professor at MIT. So I think my parents and sister have been a huge influence throughout my life in sort of how I see the world. And I don't ever tend to worry about the outcome of things. I tend to focus much more on the methods and the process to get that. Because, you know, the way the research side of the world works is, especially in those types of scientific areas, you don't actually know what the outcome is going to be. You may have some ideas, but it's really about enjoying the journey and struggling through it. So that's the biggest influence there. But the other side is, I think groups of people have had a lot of influence on me. I think my students, especially my PhD students, have been just unbelievable people for me to learn from, because they each come in and at the end, they know a lot more about certain things than I do. They become the expert and I learn from them on those things. And then on the company side, I've learned a ton from our customers. Every time I talk to them, just learn so much. So, I mean, my colleagues as well. So it's just people who have influence on me, broadly speaking, are the people who I've learned from. And there are many such people.
Excellent. Last question. Can you tell us about a charity, cause, or other endeavor that you're passionate about?
I support a few different foundations. One of them is, you know, I studied in India until I was about 20, 21, and I came to the US for graduate school. So I care a lot about social conditions there, education in particular. So I support, an example is the IIT Madras Foundation. They're part of the institute that I studied in, but they do a number of things, you know, including we did a lot for COVID relief, where in 2021, there was a lot going on with bad COVID impacts. But right now, a lot of my focus is on making sure that in India, but also in other places where access to education is not as easy to obtain, people have good access to education and to opportunities. So that's one that I care deeply about. And then more recently, I've got very interested in certain health related issues, things like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, things related to the brain. And I'm increasingly getting more involved in both understanding that and seeing what I can do to be a tiny, tiny piece of helping improve health outcomes, particularly related to mental health, broadly speaking, brain health and mental health.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Hari, I want to thank you again for taking the time to chat with us. This has been a wonderful conversation.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.